Welcome to a new 74 podcast series, Culture in a Time of Crises. I'm Shwetal Patel, host of the series in which we explore art making and art making practices during these times of crises. Join us to hear from diverse artists and thinkers about how they've spent their lockdowns and the impact it has had on their working methods. Chris Evans is an artist and musician based in Belgium. Welcome to 74 Podcasts, Chris Evans.
Thanks for inviting me, Shwetal.
I'm curious about where you grew up and went to school.
So I grew up in the north of England, in East Yorkshire, in a small village between Hull and York, called Eastrington. And it was a tiny village, 12th century church, kind of quite sweet. And then I later found out there was kind of like the drug fencing capital of the north, the drugs that were coming into this inland port, Goole, and then were being fenced through these small villages. I wasn't aware of this when I was growing up, but I later found that out.
Interesting. And where did you go to school?
In a local school, Howden Secondary Comprehensive.
And these were the Cold War years. What was that like in the north of England?
Well, I remember drawing. We were surrounded by power stations. There were six. It's like the biggest conglomeration of power stations in England is around this area, and there were six huge power stations, Drax being the main one. And then one day I drew a line. I remember when I was a kid, I drew a line between these power stations and discovered where the lines crossed was the garage of my grandparents' house. So they were like nuclear target number one in the Cold War period.
Did you tell them that?
I started to tell them that, but then I could see the expression on my grandmother's face and thought that I shouldn't continue with that. It was like I don't really so much remember the Cold War period so much as I remember the miner strike. I grew up at that time. I was going to secondary school at that time. The police were coming in and giving talks to the students, and then the miners were coming in and giving talks to students. I was doing a paper round in a local village, and occasionally there would be a house where the police would be, you know, standing outside the garage protecting the house because it was a miner that was refusing to go on strike. It was very kind of I was just very aware of the tensions in the local communities at that time. It was really kind of quite stark.
What years were these?
This would have been in the late 80s or mid 80s actually. Yeah, before I went to university.
And did that inform some of your own politics and your feelings about the deindustrialization of the coal?
Absolutely, because there was mass unemployment. The whole villages had gone to waste, and at the same time, of course, it was the Thatcher era, and my folks were low middle income, and they were they got caught up in the whole kind of like Thatcher promise of buying stocks and shares and that kind of thing, and that sort of like, you know, they felt that they could be aspirational or something.
And What were the memories of that period in terms of your decision? You know, when did you begin to consider your future out of this, you know, cauldron of local politics and things, and you wanted to kind of, what did you want to do with your life?
Well, first of all, I didn't want to stay on at school. I thought that I told my parents I just wanted to play music, and I thought that they would insist that I stayed on at school, and they didn't. So I just stayed at home and played music for a couple of weeks, and then I got bored with that, and so then I went back to school. And then during that 2 years of doing my, you know, my A-levels at the time, that's when I decided that I wanted to study either art or applied art or something in that field. And I applied for various colleges, and I went to study design in Leicester. And by the time finishing that design course, I realized that I didn't want to do design, but was like more interested in fine art and writing. And shortly after that, I saved money to travel around South America. And I was interested in the writings of Gabriel Garcia, of Marquez and Lorca and magic realism. And I wanted to interview people who were working for Pablo Escobar in Colombia to write a narrative that would, you know, that would evolve from the conversations that I had there. And so I spent a few months, mainly in Colombia, doing exactly that. And then I returned to England with this writing, and I made some illustrations to go with this, the writing that I'd made. And then with that, I applied to art school.
And were there many of your friends and peers when you were growing up that ended up in art school like you? Were you quite unusual in that?
Well, there's nobody from my school who applied to art school. To do fine art at that time was not, it did not seem like a viable career in any shape or form. In fact, I guess it was more of like a romantic notion of a life of an artist, what that might be, but no real kind of like sense of that being a possibility, just something that you would be kind of interested in. But I kind of quite like that, because it was like I also feel a little bit like that now, in that sense of being a hobbyist or interested in it being outside of a sort of unprofessional, at the borders of professionalism and what that can enable. And I kind of still kind of hold on to that notion of making art. It's not applied. It comes from your own motivation, your own interest, and so forth.
Yeah, well, so coming back to the project with Pablo Escobar, with the people, the witnesses to that horrific, period in Colombian history, and then you come back to the UK and you begin really, I suppose, to become an artist in some ways.
Yeah, I was only like 20 years old when I went there, super naive, interested in the social policies of the cartels, how they were building schools, how they're integrating themselves in society, building sports stadiums and whatsoever, at the same time as obviously everything that we know about the horror of what was going on there at the time. I just became interested in painting, I guess, and how I might kind of like try to bring form to the thoughts and ideas that I was kind of writing about, and feeling that I was much more kind of adept at kind of approaching the subject matter through visual material rather than through writing. And so, yeah, so that formed my application to art school.
Well, that's interesting, because you were making music and you began writing, which then led to your painting, and you decided then to pursue your training in art. And tell us about those years, in the late 80s, early 90s, when you would have been at art school. What was going on then?
So I took a break from doing my degree in design, and then a few years later, I studied in an art school in Barcelona. So that I could work on the side teaching English, I would be able to fund my studies. And there was this amazing studio complex that was owned by Mariscal, who'd been busy with the Olympics there. And it was amazing studio right next to the beach. And I spent just an amazing year starting from scratch, really, trying to develop a practice. Then I stayed in Spain after that for a number of years. And until one day I saw a catalogue for an exhibition that had taken place in Glasgow. I think this must have been in 93, 94. It's an exhibition called Windfall that kind of involved people like Christine Borland, Ross Sinclair, Douglas Gordon, Jonathan Monk, David Shrigley, these artists. And I looked at this catalogue and saw this show, and then I looked at my own work, and I thought that there was such a gap in what I was producing, and my interest and excitement of what I was seeing in the catalogue for this exhibition, that I decided to leave Spain and move to Glasgow. I moved to Glasgow, and then I kind of found myself involved in, very, very quickly with a group of friends making music. I ran a small publishing outfit called Stop, 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 and we published myself and my partner at the time, Caroline Woodley, published this history of art and music in Glasgow since 1973 to the present time, which is the late 90s at that point, by the writer Sarah Lowndes, and got introduced to a whole bunch of people, met new friends, and quickly formed this band that then went off on its own trajectory by itself.
And what kind of music were you making in the band, and what was it called?
It's called Life Without Buildings. And well, we started off, there were three of us, myself, Robert Johnson, and Will Bradley. And we were interested mainly in electronic music. We were interested in bands like Aphex Twin, Underground Resistance, bands like that. And then we quickly realized that we had no capabilities of making music like that. And then I bought a bass guitar. Robert started playing guitar. Will Bradley was playing drums, and we were kind of more following our interest in bands like Gang of Four and The Fall and early Simple Minds, Magazine, Patti Smith. And then one day we were at Transmission Gallery, and there was a performance by local artists, including Kathy Wilkes, Hayley Tompkins, Sue Tompkins. And we were just astounded by the by Sue Tompkins' performance, who was reading out this poetry, this stream of consciousness writing that she'd been making. And immediately after that performance, myself, Will, and Robert got together and, you know, decided we would ask Sue if she wanted to come and kind of rehearse with us and see what might come of that. And I very much remember the first occasion meeting in a bedroom at Robert's house, and I brought a bass riff and Robert was playing. And then we were playing for like 20 minutes, half an hour. And then Sue started speaking, singing. And we were just kind of quite frankly amazed by her delivery, the nuances of how she, you know, controls her cadence, and somehow how that kind of enveloped the music that we were playing and playing off that. That then kind of became my life for 3 years, making music with the band Life Without Buildings with Sue, Robert, and Will. And we played a first gig in London. I think it must have been like 99. And there was a guy there who was working with an affiliation of Rough Trade called Tugboat. And he heard us play. We only had three songs. And then he suggested to Jeff Travis at Rough Trade that we might want to put this out as a single. And so we did. And then that quickly kind of became the album that we made called Any Other City. And yeah, for a period we were touring around Europe, around Britain, did a tour in Australia, and yeah, that became what we all did for a while. It was very magical.
Yeah, it sounds extremely magical. Your visual arts practice in that sense, I suppose, draws from a background in music and vice versa. What is the relationship between the oral and the visual in contemporary art for you today?
That's such a difficult question to answer, because I've just been doing selections at the Ateliers, this institution where I work in Amsterdam. And as we do the selections, often you find people who are making sculptures, and then they're also kind of like, you know, including audio works. And whenever you hear the audio works, it feels like they're having problems with their sculptures. And when they're doing the sculptures, it feels like they're quite not sure about the audio work that they're submitting. So I'm kind of confused. And I was thinking, is that why I'm making audio works? Are some of the things I'm doing? I mean, I don't think so, but it did cross my mind. But no, actually the structure of how I make the audio works as part of the work that I do kind of follows a similar structure to the way that I make sculptural works. And these come out of a conversation. For the recent pieces that I've been making called Jingles, I ask an institution if they are financially stable or not. And if they are financially stable, then I offered to work with a farmer that is local to the institution. And if they're not, then I work with their accountant. And I play percussion noises to the accountant or the farmer, and I ask them to mimic these sounds. And then I make short bass bass sounds and notes, which are kind of inspired by the transition jingles that you hear in American sitcoms, when you go from one scene to another, like Friends or Frasier, and it would be a simple kind of like bass riff that tells you that you're moving into a different scene. And so I thought, well, I could take this kind of like this small kind of like bass part, add in this kind of like human beatbox from the farmer or the accountant, and make this small kind of like audio piece that could serve as a transition. And it sort of like it's triggered by senses when people enter and exit an exhibition or an institution. And it kind of marks the entrance and exit of a person visiting. So also kind of like performs this kind of transition between public and private space. And so I make them for each venue. At the moment, there's one in a show that's here in Brussels in a space called Le Sage, which I made a couple of weeks ago. Okay, so that sound that I just played there was the jingle that I made for a show called Village Lawyer at a center of art Neuchâtel in Switzerland. So this was a show called Village Lawyer that I did 2018. And for this one, I made it with a local farmer because it's a Swiss institution. They're not short of funds.
So this idea of working with the farmer in this instance, or previously you've worked with the police, what's the fascination with working with civil society figures such as these? In the case of the police, of course, can be quite controversial.
Well, I think my interest is in the consideration that art comes out of a negotiation of beliefs, a negotiation of ideology, and the situation between the artist and the patron, or the artist and who is funding the work, who is, you know, pushing the work forward, the mechanisms of how things get decided, how and in what way things are decided in what gets produced and what gets made and what gets seen. And so therefore it makes sense to work with people who are, you know, in different kind of walks of life, but usually it's people who I choose for their, you know, where there's kind of like a symbolic resonance to their role. So it could be the police, it could be judges, it could be a very kind of like exclusive jewelry company that's funding a biennial, and I would try to divert the money that they are giving to the biennial, but to actually produce a piece of work themselves for the biennial, which is what I did for the 2014 biennial in Liverpool. But going back to the police have been, I've worked with now for, I must be around 10, 15 years now, and I invite them to come to art schools to recruit art students to join the police. And whenever I suggest this to the art schools, they're somewhat reluctant because they are often kind of like, would want to kind of like stick to the notion that one goes to art school in order to become an artist. Was, as we know, this is not true, and it's also not necessarily the value that we might want to have for art education. Maybe we want to consider art education as being, you know, so useful to any walks of life. And from the other side of the coin was to think that for a police to best serve its constituents would be if it reflects the demographics of a society in a wider way. So therefore, it would make sense if there are artists would join the police force and bring their qualities and values to, to that work, to that life. And so, but what tends to happen is that when I do these police recruitment talks, is that it's like putting up a two-way mirror, in that each kind of profession, each vocation sees oneself kind of like amplified or mirrored to oneself. And therefore, I've noticed that there seems to be kind of this kind of like, almost like a wall in between the students on the one hand and the police on the other, who is, you know, giving them a talk into the values of joining the police and what that might offer them. And the questions that the artists ask kind of like, you know, start off kind of quite simple in terms of, you know, why do you carry arms? Why do you, how do you perform in a situation where your government is asking you to do something that you do not feel that you can morally and consciously ally yourself with? The questions start off simple and then they get more interesting and more complex. But my reason for doing it, although it sounds like it's kind of quite binary or to take two seemingly opposite professions, is actually quite earnest, in that I do think we would have a better police forces if artists would join.
That's really an intriguing idea. It brings me to your role as a permanent supervisor that you mentioned at the ateliers in Amsterdam. Can you tell us a bit more about that program and why you feel it's important for artists such as yourself to be involved in teaching?
Yeah, absolutely. It's so the Ateliers was set up in 1963. It was set up by artists. It was set up by Stanley Brown, Jan Dibitz, Toon Verhoef. And the setup was initiated out of a frustration with the current art education, mainstream art education in the Netherlands at the time. So it was based in Haarlem at the beginning, and then a number of years later it moved to Amsterdam. So there are no qualifications to be gained from this. This would be, the principle was that it would be for artists that had either left art school or hadn't gone to art school, that would want to work in a studio where there would be once a week, every Tuesday, visiting artists that would, you know, enter into conversations between them. So it's like between artists and peers. The idea that it would be, you know, horizontal, horizontal rather than a vertical scenario between artists who have some experience out there in the world and artists who are at the beginning of their career. And this kind of principle kind of exists to this day. I mean, it seems sometimes a little bit kind of, somehow, even though the kind of like setup originally was that it should be super horizontal, it can feel a little bit at odds with that in terms of visiting artists just knock on the studio doors of the participants and then ask if they want to have a discussion about their work, rather than it being the other way around, rather than participants inviting people. But what the benefits of that is that you are forced to kind of enter into conversations that you might not kind of like, you might not welcome. There might be questions for somebody who does not ally themselves with your practice, where coming from very, you know, diverse positions, and this can be quite difficult. It can be quite hard to navigate, but I also think it's, you know, very essential for people to kind of confront, you know, a diverse range of opinions that might not sit so easily and well with how you consider what you're doing with your practice. So it's a very small institution. There are 2 years, these people come in for these, you know, quite luxurious studios for 2 years. 10 people get accepted each year. And at the moment we're doing selections, and we're just kind of like whittling it down from over 1,000 applicants to just 10 people who will take just to begin this next autumn.
And how does the field look this year in comparison to previous years? Do you feel that there are more applications this year? Are the qualities better or is the opposite?
There are definitely more applications. I think last year maybe it was like 700, 800. I kind of wonder if people during these COVID times kind of want to feel the warm embrace of an institution or something. Or obviously people kind of, if they've left college and they're, you know, kind of struggling to do shows at this current time, a lot of people maybe just want to kind of enter an institution, have a studio, have these conversations in order to kind of, you know, keep going with what they're doing. So it's like, it's a really difficult process to look through this work and to see so much, you know, so much amazing things happening out there and having to kind of go through this process of, you know, whittling it down to this small number. And really kind of, it's quite a complex scenario of seeing what would make an interesting group and a varied group of people. But the quality is, as every year, I think kind of to a similar outstanding, you know, level. I mean, it's amazing what's out there. It's a real pleasure and a privilege to look through this work and select people for the program.
And what's it been like for the current batch at the Atelier during 2020 and continuing?
I can quite easily say that it has been an absolute nightmare for them. They have arrived, the current group that arrived in October have been in quarantine several times. They've all had COVID. They've been, you know, locked down in tiny flats, groups coming together, didn't know each other. Visiting artists have not been able to visit. There's been lots of these, you know, Zoom conversations. And this is not a structure that serves well for doing artist studio visits, you know, where your eyes can wander to wherever they want to go in the room to look at tiny pieces of work that might be on the floor that are discarded, but might be of interest. Instead, it's this kind of really kind of, as you know, this kind of quite intense situation of looking at people directly, which is really kind of like quite unnerving and really unsuitable for this kind of, yeah, for studio practice and for studio conversations. I mean, how have you found working like this, Shvetal?
Discombobulating.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I just can't look at people for that long. I just can't.
Yeah, no, absolutely. They'll not being in the same room and so on. Yeah. I think a great deal gets lost.
Yeah, I mean, I think also to actually look at somebody in that kind of like proximity. I've read somewhere that you would never look at somebody in that proximity unless it was an intimate relationship or an aggressive scenario, one or the other. I mean, with those two now, I would like to think that it's intimate rather than aggressive.
Yes, absolutely. I hope so. Moving on to your life in Brussels, you live with your wife, who's also an artist, Melissa Gordon. What was it like during the lockdown having an artist as a partner?
Well, we have quite a large studio that we split the room up into two, and we would.
So you live together and you share the same building, the studio.
Yes. Not. Yeah,
I mean, but you don't split your house up, of course.
No, we don't. We have kind of we don't. We don't do that. But I mean, in the studio, we have like a dividing wall. That's kind of flexible depending on who's doing.
No, I've actually been to the studio. It's an incredible space.
Yeah. And but prior to this kind of period, one of us would be away. You know, Melissa teaches in Oslo at the Art Academy there. I'm in Amsterdam, occasionally in Liverpool. So we would kind of like switch the studio time around. And usually it would just be one of us working there. And then, of course, over this last year, then there's both of us working there. Melissa's doing her paintings. I'm often trying to do these audio music pieces, one that I'm working on at the moment with regards to the kind of considering the politics of intonation and starting to work with various people who work with an interest in that. And it doesn't go well together. Somebody kind of like making a lot of noise in one space, another person trying to paint, and then the Zoom conversations and things like that. So we're kind of like trying to split it up a bit better now. Otherwise we'll drive each other quite crazy.
Yeah. Well, talking about craziness, you know, since Brexit, the UK art sector has been somewhat cut off from the EU art sector. It's going to be increasingly difficult for lots of artists to operate within Europe. So as a Brussels-based British artist, what are you feeling right now?
I had a number of gigs, a number of concerts that I was going to play in Britain that running up to February, March last year, it was becoming very, very quickly complicated, if not impossible to do because of visas. The person that I work with is coming from Berlin, he's Norwegian, and the paperwork involved in just coming to play one concert in Britain is just, you know, incredible, to the point where it really just becomes quite impossible. And I'm sure that's the same case for a number of, you know, for all British artists, musicians working in Britain trying to travel to Europe. It's like they must feel completely cut off, frustrated. And I know there's been a number of petitions, there's been a number of conversations in Parliament about this, and I've not seen anything that has been done about this yet. It's kind of, it's quite incredible to think that this kind of whole sector, this lucrative sector, both for culture and for finance, has been completely neglected in these negotiations.
Also comes at a time where news is emerging that funding for arts in higher education in the UK is going to be cut drastically up to or more than 50%. And this is, of course, on top of cuts over the last 10 years.
Yeah, I read this yesterday. 50% is just unbelievable. I mean, I read the first paragraph of the article and I just couldn't read anymore. I was hoping when Brexit happened that, you know, the app on my phone for the Guardian newspaper would just like implode. And then I would no longer have to know what is happening. But it's not true. And I checked the app yesterday and this was the first news that I read. And I was kind of completely astonished by the short-sightedness of this. And it's just incredible.
Yeah, well, it brings me to your involvement with the Liverpool Biennial. You were a participant in 2014 and later you joined their board of trustees. Why do you think it's important for artists to sit on institutional boards like this? And are there potentially conflicts of interest?
I was asked to join the Biennial Board of Trustees in 2015, I think it was, maybe even a little bit after that. But after I'd taken part in the Biennial...
You must have really impressed them.
I think it was actually... They were conscious that I'd had some difficulties in the Biennial, with some work that got kind of damaged during the install and things like that. And they were kind of keen to hear about my experience of that or to know how things could be managed better. And through various conversations with the Biennial at that time, which were good conversations, they seemed kind of like interested in what I, you know, could bring to a conversation around, What are the qualities and values of a biennial that interests artists? What is their experience of this? What could be better for the experience for artists? What do they get out of it? What opportunities can they feel that they can present themselves and present the community, of Liverpool? And so my interest, so on joining the trustees, I quickly became aware that it was very necessary to become an advocate for the art and to be supportive of quite challenging ideas that might be brought to the table and brought to the table of a board of trustees, which would be largely where their profession would be in finance or in public relations or marketing. So, I mean, I think it's more important not to be a lone voice as an artist as a trustee on a board, and that it's necessary to have two or more, but that as a single person trustee for a while there, it felt very important that I should be an advocate for what the ideas that were being brought to the table by the director and by the invited curators. And then I became quite close to curators who have been involved in the biennial, and I felt that because they are not kind of employees with permanent contracts, that they might find it useful to have somebody who could be a bridge between the organization and themselves and their own ambitions, and to kind of like, yeah, to be a sounding board for these ideas. I mean, I love that. There's nothing that kind of like interests me more than talking around ideas how should a biennial serve its community? How does that get presented and received in this kind of environment? And how might that be changed for the future?
And have you been able to get the Liverpool Constabulary involved?
Or you mean whether I should bring the police in to recruit?
Well, the police to be involved somewhat in the biennial. My own experience in Kochi with the Kochi biennial, the police are very much aware of what's happening at the biennial. They're, of course, coming to visit. We encourage them and their families to come. And we have young cadets come along as well that are training for, you know, the sort of youth. So they're very much involved with the police in that sense. And I think it goes back to, I think, what you were trying to say earlier, that perhaps the world might be a slightly kinder place if we had more art school training for police officers.
Well, Shvetl, it sounds like you're doing my job. It sounds like you're doing my job for me. I haven't involved the constabulary, the local police in Liverpool, but I like the idea of that. Why not?
Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, right, moving on. I mean, as you know, we're kind of, it's a very, very difficult and strange picture globally right now, although we've been in this lockdown scenario in Europe since March 2020. You in Belgium are slowly emerging, as is Western Europe and America. But of course, many, many parts of the world are still going through a kind of severe crisis, really. And what has been, you know, what's been your overall impression looking back over the last 12 months? You know, has it been a productive period for you, or do you feel that it's really been wasted time, or has it been a mixed feeling?
Yeah. I don't think it's been a wasted time in that I've been very involved in a couple of institutions trying to navigate ways through this. And I could only, you know, I could only think of this time as being generative and productive. It's been very challenging, and it's been about trying to navigate ways through this, particularly with the ateliers and trying to come up with a different structure of how it might operate in the future, given the difficulties that we found in this last year. What the experiences of people, you know, traveling from all over the world coming to Amsterdam. So it's like lockdown times two. You know, it's like the lockdown that the state is implementing locally, and then a lockdown that's kind of comes from, you know, being a foreigner and being a stranger to a place and arriving in this situation. So I've been involved on a daily basis with this. And I think, like a lot of people who've been serving on boards and advisory boards, they have found that their work has tripled or quadrupled in this time. There has been so much to do. And I think, and we've been really struggling with this, it really takes its toll. I'm trying to think of something positive to say about this. I really struggle. I really do struggle. I think it's been, and the knock-on effect on my practice and making work has been super severe. It has been to the point where, you know, it's hard to kind of like be in the studio and gather one's thoughts about what one does. I mean, it almost feels like what I used to do is kind of this kind of strange dream. You know, this strange fantasy, and so I'm making some, you know, personal decisions around that with regards to how I separate my time and how I must recreate my studio as a place of practice, as a place of studio practice, away from the computer screen, and considering thoughts and reading and writing an idea generation that is separated from this time where I've been, you know, on a screen and navigating ways through problems that the institutions that I work for have been facing during these times. I'm sure I echo the thoughts of many, many people with that. As far as the local situation goes in here in Brussels, as you know, Belgium was one of the kind of like most severely hit in Europe in terms of numbers and so forth. And since October last year, we've been in a constant kind of like quasi lockdown with curfew that's been at 10 o'clock. This is since October. But this curfew lifts tomorrow. So I'm going to go out tonight, and curfew is at 10 o'clock, but I'm thinking that if I stay out between 10 o'clock and midnight, then tomorrow, since curfew is lifted, then I should be able to come home tomorrow in the early hours of the morning, but I'm not sure.
I wanted to really end by asking about the rest of the year, apart from looking forward to open pubs and restaurants and so on. What's on your agenda?
My agenda is getting back to work in the studio, getting back to what I'm, picking up the pieces of what I was working on before, working on a small commission for the Collective Gallery in Edinburgh that might grow into something bigger, working on this music piece, which is a collaborative project that I'm doing. A number of projects like that. That's what I'm going to be busy with as soon as I get back to studio.
You're a father of two lovely twins who I've also had the pleasure of meeting.
Yes. The amazing thing here is that, and it's actually due to a member of government who comes from a kind of quite far right party, insisted that school children still go to school during this period. So despite there being, you know, constant lockdowns, curfews and so forth, the schools, apart from in the first lockdown period, the schools have remained open. And this has been an absolute, you know, godsend, really.
Chris, on that note, which slightly positive, we thank you for joining us for the podcast.
My pleasure, Shvetal. Take care. No.